From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is decision day, and though some races may not be definitively decided when we wake up tomorrow, eventually there will be victory parties and memes of teary supporters. It's pretty easy to sound gracious in a victory speech. We're giving a second thought to the ones no one wants to deliver, the concession speech.
The American people have spoken, and they have spoken clearly. A little while ago, I had the honor of calling Senator Barack Obama to congratulate him. Please. To congratulate him on being elected the next president of the country that we both love.
Brady Carlson, our colleague and host of All Things Considered at Wisconsin Public Radio, is with us. He's author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Hello, Brady.
It's so great to be with you, Virginia.
But let's go back through the history. Democracy was initially a fragile, largely untried thing at the beginning of the Republic. Winners and losers were not determined by a popular vote. So was the concession speech a thing then?
It wasn't a thing in the way we know them now. So it wasn't in 1796 that candidates were stepping up in, you know, the local tavern or wherever and giving a concession speech, at least not that I've been able to find. But that said, there have been moments in which political figures were coming together, sometimes after very contentious elections, and that dates back to the very first time in American history that one party gave power over to another. That was the election of 1800. This was, even by today's standards, a very nasty election. The backers of the incumbent president, John Adams, were saying that if the challenger, Thomas Jefferson, were to be elected, the government would start encouraging murder, thievery, prostitution, adultery, incest. This horrible list goes on and on. Meanwhile, Jefferson's people called President Adams a warmonger. They said maybe he's starting to go senile. Anyway, Jefferson wound up winning the election. Adams went home to Massachusetts, and there were some hard feelings. But just a few weeks after this transition, former President Adams sent new President Jefferson a letter saying that, and I quote, "This part of the Union is in a state of perfect tranquility, and I see nothing to obscure your prospect of a quiet and prosperous administration, which I heartily wish you." And so from the very beginning, there's this impulse in U.S. politics that even if elections get very contentious, after the votes are counted, people start to come together.
So that was a letter. When did we start to see the losing candidate go before the public and say, well, I just sent a messenger or telegraph or phone call to la-di-da and congratulated them on their victory?
That came as candidates could start to speak to the country through mass media, at first radio. There's a book called Almost President by Scott Ferris, which looks at these losing candidates. And he found that the first modern concession speech, at least for a presidential candidate, was in 1928 when the Democratic nominee Al Smith conceded to Republican Herbert Hoover. The first concession speech on TV then came in 1952, Adlai Stevenson conceding to Dwight D. Eisenhower. Now, this winds up being a separate piece of ending a campaign. So it doesn't take the place of the personal notes or the private calls or the congratulatory telegram that candidates are giving to each other to concede the race. Those continued with one notable exception. In 1944, the Republican challenger, Thomas E. Dewey, conceded to President Franklin Roosevelt on the radio. He didn't send a telegram to the president first, and FDR found this very irritating. So he sent Dewey a passive-aggressive telegram saying, "Thanks for your concession speech, which I heard on the radio, not through a telegram from you to me."
Well, besides those kind of surprises, have there been any common themes or flourishes in concession speeches?
As it turns out, the concession speech is one of the most standard types of speeches we have. There's a political theorist, Paul Corcoran, who studied decades and decades of presidential concession speeches, and he was struck by how much the times changed, but the speeches didn't. They all kind of had the same elements and often in the same order. They often start with a candidate noting that they had sent sent congratulations to the winner. Corcoran even notes that candidates rarely ever say that they lost, it's just that the other side won. They go on to say that they have accepted the result, they call for unity and common ground, they thank their supporters, and then they usually also promise to keep fighting for whatever it was that they stood for in the campaign. Corcoran had a conclusion that these speeches are structured in the same way because they have an important public function. There's no law that says a winning candidate can't take a public office if the loser doesn't concede. But because we have this tradition or this expectation that a losing candidate will concede, it helps society feel like the elections and the system of elections are legitimate. And maybe the best example of that in modern times came in the year 2000. That was a very contested presidential election. But after the U.S. Supreme Court gave that big ruling on the recount in Florida, Al Gore conceded the election to George W. Bush.
Let there be no doubt. While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
So the political line goes on with the concession. Have there been cases where people did not concede?
One that comes to mind for me was in the year 1876, which was even more controversial of an election than the one in 2000. The Democratic nominee Samuel Tilden won the popular vote over the Republican nominee Rutherford B. Hayes and could have made a pretty good case that he actually won the Electoral College too, which would have made him president. But there was voter fraud of every kind in certain parts of the country, and officials in certain states basically refused to certify the results in the hopes that there was a way that Hayes could still win. They turned it all over to an election review board who voted along party lines that Hayes was the winner of the disputed electoral votes and therefore the winner of the election. Now, Tilden didn't challenge the result per se, but he didn't go as far as Al Gore and accept it in his concession speech either. He spoke to a group in New York and said that voters were basically defrauded. The most conciliatory thing he said in that address was, quote, "The Republic will live." In other words, this was a bad, bad, bad election, but we've been through worse, so we just got to wait for justice. There was a pretty high-profile case of that, too, in the special election in Alabama's U.S. Senate race. The news networks were all calling the race for the Democrat, Doug Jones, but Republican Roy Moore said, and I quote, "This battle is not over." I think this raises an important point. If the function of a concession speech is that it helps legitimize the system and helps legitimize election results, what might it mean if more and more candidates decided not to concede?
Well, that defied the political norm of conceding defeat. But there are also those who left losing elections pretty embittered. Here's Richard Nixon after losing California's 1962 governor's race to Pat Brown.
But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference, and I hope that what I have said today will at least make television, radio, the press recognize that they have a right and a responsibility that if they're against a candidate, give him the shaft.
Burn from Richard Nixon. But that was not his last press conference. Did his show of being a poor loser hurt him?
At first, yes. In fact, the candidate who beat Nixon in that race famously remarked after hearing the speech, he said that's going to haunt him for the rest of his life. And there were people who were literally writing the political obituary of Richard Nixon. But as wound up being his pattern in his career, Nixon just laid low for a few years, stayed out of the public eye, and then rebranded himself when he reemerged in 1968. And of course, at that point, he went on to win the presidency.
I'm speaking with presidential historian Brady Carlson, the author of the book Dead Presidents, and we're talking about concession speeches, something that we're probably going to be hearing quite a bit of in the next couple of days. Brady, any standouts on the opposite end of the spectrum than Richard Nixon?
There are a couple that stand out for me. One is from Georgia's own president, Jimmy Carter, in the 1980 election.
Way to play your audience,
baby. I think it's particularly difficult when you're the incumbent, especially the incumbent president, and the people decide not to reelect you. It's got to hurt, and particularly for Carter, who lost pretty handily to Ronald Reagan in that election. And he was upfront about it. He talked about this does not feel good to have to give a concession speech when you've just gotten walloped in your reelection bid.
Well, let's hear that.
I promised you 4 years ago that I would never lie to you. So I can't stand here tonight and say it doesn't hurt.
And then he goes on to say,
but we must now come together as a united and a unified people to solve the problems that are still before us, to meet the challenges of a new decade. And I urge all of you to join in with me in a sincere and fruitful effort to support my successor when he undertakes this great responsibility as president of the greatest nation on earth.
Well, I mean, it has to be, you know, after you put yourself out there, there's a kind of personal sense of rejection. How do politicians steel themselves against that?
I think deep down it does hurt, no matter how big of a name you have, no matter how far you've come, to end up on the losing end of a big vote like that. I think for some of them, they get through it because they feel like it's a way they can contribute something beyond their personal feelings. Here's a way I can help bring the election into a harmonious conclusion. Some of them have future plans, and they know that people are going to be watching to see whether or not they look like a sore loser. And I've also heard giving a concession speech described as like a pastoral role. You can kind of soothe these hurt feelings. You have people who believed in your campaign, who worked really hard for you, and they've come up short. They feel hurt. They feel upset. Maybe they're really angry. And maybe you're the only person who can help soothe some of those hurt feelings.
Right. They play up the stakes of their difference, but then they rise to the occasion and say, we're all together now. Any other standouts for you, Brady, for concession speeches?
Well, right now, I think the gold standard on a concession speech is from 10 years ago when Arizona Senator John McCain really leaned into the sentiments that characterized a good concession. He lost to Democratic U.S. Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, and he pointedly referred to Obama as the man who would be his next president. And he pointed out multiple times what a historic moment it was that Americans had just elected a person of color for the first time as president of the United States.
A century ago, President Theodore Roosevelt's invitation of Booker T. Washington to dine at the White House was taken as an outrage in many quarters. America today is a world away from the cruel and prideful bigotry of that time. There is no better evidence of this than the election of an African-American to the presidency of the United States.
A real statesman there, John McCain conceding defeat in 2008 to Barack Obama. How about outliers, shortest on record, longest, you know, mic drops? Any candidates just unable to summon the gumption to say, I lost?
Well, there was one case where the candidate probably could have summoned the gumption, but he couldn't summon the voice. In 1976, President Gerald Ford was crisscrossing the country at the very last minute. It was a tight election against Jimmy Carter. And at the end, his voice gave out. And so the morning after, when it was finally clear that he had lost his bid for a full term as president, he wrote a concession speech. And he couldn't give it. So he stood next to First Lady Betty Ford, who delivered the speech on his behalf.
Well, digging through presidential history, as you do, is there any, you know, record of people grappling with how to do it? You know, is it sort of like the obit desk at the newspaper that you prepare one if you win and one if you lose?
Writing concession speeches is like a thing in a campaign that everybody knows you probably need to do, but nobody wants to be the one to bring it up, because who wants to be the staffer who reminds the candidate that they might lose? Most candidates, most campaigns, at least in close elections, have a speech on hand as a just in case. But there's one famous case in 2012 when Mitt Romney was running as the Republican candidate for president. And he was pretty well convinced that he was going to beat Barack Obama, so much so that no one wrote a concession speech for election night. And then the campaign realized that he had lost. And it turned out there were cameras in the room filming a documentary. And they caught this kind of awkward moment where they had to figure out what to do.
So what do you say if we, what do you think you say in a concession speech? What do you reach what I have here at Suits today? It just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations.
So that speaks to the kind of formulaic nature of it. He did all the right things. How about the real mic drops? Got any in mind?
Well, you have kind of an interesting moment in the primaries for Congress this past year when the longtime incumbent in New York State, Joe Crowley, lost to the progressive challenger Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He wished this Dark Horse candidate well, to the point that he actually played a song for her. He played Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run as if she was born to run for public office. If you can play a song for the candidate who just beat you, then that's probably a sign that you're taking it well.
And advice to Joe Crowley, if you're looking for a new job, I'm not thinking singer is one of them.
We'd say don't quit your day job, except you kind of just lost it.
Brady Carlson, he's host of All Things Considered at Wisconsin Public Radio and author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Thank you so much, Brady.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Virginia. Thank you.
Just ahead, how does one get back up after being knocked down in an election? That's coming up after the break. This is On Second Thought.